Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I will be talking to Sarah Quinn, who is the author of American Bonds, How Credit Markets Shaped a Nation. The book is published by Princeton University Press, and I have the real pleasure to have Sarah on the phone today. Sarah, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Yeah, I've read this really, really interesting book. And learned a little bit about you and your background. Would you share a little bit about who you are before we talk about your book?
Sure. I'm an associate professor of sociology at the University of Washington, and I'm an economic sociologist, so I tend to study politics and culture and markets.
Yeah, the book and I can imagine in its research and its writing how you span so many different areas of expertise and weave them together. You must have felt like you were wearing three or four or five different disciplinary hats each time you sat down to work on this book. It really does feel like something it would speak to a number of different areas, including political science. And so let's talk about the book, American Bonds. As I suggested, the book covers a lot of ground. But the key terms, I think, are likely unknown or maybe even misunderstood by even the most attuned readers of American policy development. I wonder if we could start with some definitions of two of those terms. So what is securitization? And in general terms, what are federal credit programs? Maybe we can start there and then we can move on.
Yeah, those are great questions. So securitization is a financial technology, and it involves taking a group of assets like mortgages and combining them into a pool and then selling off shares of the pool. And since the 1980s, this has really grown to be the center of global financial systems. And it was the financial technology at the heart of the housing bubble that preceded the 2008 crash. So that's securitization. Federal credit programs are government programs that buy, sell, insure, or guarantee loans, or otherwise try to direct credit to certain parts of the economy or certain groups by incentivizing lending. And the reason I study them together is because our modern securitization market actually grew out of part of a broader effort of the federal credit program.
Yeah, these concepts and sort of the study of the government's role in credit markets and lending and in how loans have shaped the country makes it such an interesting and historic read. At the start of the book, you introduced this idea of political lightness. And I think it has a lot to do with the sort of the political science of this, of these concepts that are really drawn out of finance and in the study of markets. I don't think I've seen this phrase before, but it's so fitting for your subject matter. What do you mean that credit policies can have this sort of effect of being politically light?
When I started studying why the government was so active in getting involved in credit markets the way it was, it became really clear very quickly that it wasn't just that markets need help, though it's true that markets need help, and a lot of scholars have studied that for a long time, but it was also that government officials were using credit and inducements around credit markets to solve all sorts of problems. So if you want to increase access to higher education, why not offer school loans? Or if you want to promote infrastructure, rather than taxing and spending money on infrastructure, you could guarantee the loans of a private company that's doing it. So I wanted to understand why credit was being used in those ways, especially at times when a problem didn't necessarily have to be considered a credit problem. And what I learned, especially drawing from some other scholars who've been researching federal credit, is that credit has a lot of flexibility politically. In some ways, it's a lot like tax expenditures. So it's easier to pass through through committees. When a government issues a loan, that loan may get paid back, so it might make money over time. A guarantee doesn't cost a government anything until the loan, until the loan itself goes bust. They are easy to get off budget. They often work through partnerships, and they kind of sound and seem like the market, which gives them a broad ideological appeal and government officials a lot of flexibility for how they talk about it. And all of this adds up to it being a really, really useful policy tool. So government officials figured out pretty early on that they could use credit to solve a lot of problems, and importantly, to solve problems in ways that were kind of easier to pass than other more expensive programs.
Now, many of the references you've made so far are somewhat contemporary uses of this policy tool, but the book really does trace this back into its much longer history and is part of why your subtitle, How Credit Markets Shaped a Nation, is accurate. This is really a historical look at this. In one of the early chapters, you look at the movement of the U.S. westward, and we typically think of this as one that's really a story of politics and war, but you add to this finance. Why were innovations in lending practices so important to expansion in the U.S.?
I often start with contemporary examples to try to make it relevant for people. But I do, as I was doing the research on this project, I came to believe that this was the kind of relationship of U.S. political institutions and U.S. financial markets had some of these core dynamics that go back to the earliest days of the nation. The use of credit looked really different at different times. So I actually open up with a discussion of I start after the Revolutionary War, when the national government is looking for a way to pay down war debt and doesn't want to raise taxes and realizes that it can sell off land, that it has lots of land that it can use as a resource. And it goes to kind of sell off this land. And even with selling off the land in what seems like a pretty cheap way, settlers still couldn't afford it. So the government, through the land offices, starts selling this land on credit. And it ends up being part of a boom and a bust in 1819, where millions of dollars are defaulted to the federal government. And two dozen relief acts are passed around this policy to provide some relief for settlers. And I argue that this is actually a core dynamic, that government officials continually turn to land as a resource and to property ownership as a resource, as a political resource. But land also always involves credit. Land itself in a kind of a capitalist system doesn't mean anything unless you can sink some kind of money into it to turn it into a farm or to allow somebody to buy and sell it. So because the U.S. government was always in the real estate business, it always had to grapple with credit markets. but it looked really different ways at different times. So in the 19th century, to the extent that we get credit programs, what we really get are these ad hoc programs that are really backup for something else. So you get credit supports for the railroads. It's a backup for another policy, and it's going to end. What changes in the 19th century. What changes in the 20th century is that credit really comes into its own as its own policy tool and is used systematically and widely for a variety of policy reasons and across sectors.
Now, later in the book, you describe this fascinating trip a group of lawmakers take to Europe in 1912. This trip ended with the adoption of the Federal Farm Loan Act. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where this U.S. delegation went, what they were particularly impressed by, and what they brought back to the U.S. at the end of the trip.
I'm so glad you mentioned it, because that is actually one of my favorite parts of the story. So what happened for much of the 19th century is, after getting burned with the Farm Loan Act, especially, and with a lot of with a lack of kind of political support for the government to be systematically involved in credit markets, there was just this endemic problem with access to credit. And it's not that there were credit shortages so much as that there'd be these huge booms and these big busts, and it was very destabilizing. And what you have happening by the early 1900s is progressives are looking towards U.S. farms, realizing that there's huge problems with farm communities. And they realize very quickly that credit distribution is a part of the problem, that if farmers don't have access to kind of regular, reliable credit for farming, their communities just won't thrive. So as was pretty common in the progressive era, commissions are sent over to Europe to investigate European solutions. And the commissions they send to figure out farm credit are the biggest of the commissions from the U.S. that kind of went over to Europe at the time. And they tour the entire continent. They go even to Egypt, and they're going around Europe looking to see what other countries are doing. And what they end up adopting is a version of the Prussian system. In fact, when it comes to figuring out long-term credit, nation after nation is adopting in some way and adjusting the Prussian system, because the Prussians had figured out way before anybody else how to move credit across a large, sparsely populated frontier. Through these banks that issued bonds that were backed by mortgages. So when they get to Germany, they're asking about the system of farm loan finance, and they decide to bring it back to the U.S. that this is the best system, but they're going to make it an American system. And what that means is they say, look, the German system has very careful credit protections based on the fact that every farmer in the system is entirely on the hook if another farmer that's connected through their land bank goes under. And we're not going to do that in the U.S. Americans just won't be that interested in taking care of each other. So we're going to make it so there's like less of a liability for other people. They come back with this organizational idea, but I also argue that really importantly, they come back with a new way of thinking and talking about systematic government involvement in credit distribution. Before, it was really seen as a dangerous form of paternalism in the U.S. And what the commission brings back from Europe is this idea that credit can be a way for the government to help people help themselves. And so it's not paternalistic, and it's not government overreach. It's just a way to boost the private market.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Now, as the country moves from a largely agrarian to a manufacturing economy based in cities, you describe a shift to government finance for home ownership. Again, this is more than just about finance. This is about political and social meaning. How did government lending programs feature in this dramatic societal shift away from the family farm?
So there's always high levels of property ownership in the U.S. What you get with industrialization as people move into the city are you're going to get moving into the 20th century increasingly high levels of home ownership. And the government, the federal government, kind of first starts with farm loan distribution with the Federal Farm Loan Act in 1916. But it's going to move dramatically in the New Deal towards supporting home ownership. So the home loan bank system is in many ways set up following the model of the home of the farm loan system. And you get in the New Deal as home ownership, urban home ownership, and suburban home ownership becomes more important, massive amounts of government credit support for housing. And it's very explicit that, you know, FDR understands that credit is an affordable way to promote home building. And home building is not just about housing policy. Home building is also an industrial policy. Home construction is a major employer. It's about keeping people employed. And it's about promoting all the industries that go into building a home. So not just the wood and the brick that goes into the house, but also the transportation of those resources to a home. And then all the consumer goods that go into the home. So the federal government figures out very quickly that they can use credit, home credit, to support the economy. And they actually figure out not long after that if you can use credit to boost the economy, you can also use it to slow it down. So what you have by the middle of the post-war era is that government regulations of credit markets and housing finance are really being used as part of a system for controlling the growth of the economy. So it really puts kind of housing credit at the center of a lot of dynamics in U.S. markets.
Now, you describe many of these programs, and we've just named and alluded to a small number of them, but there are many more built around a similar kind of formula. But you describe them as largely successful in addressing a variety of social programs, including recovery from the Great Depression. But on race, the issue is not quite so clear. How do African Americans participate in these programs, especially the housing programs? And what explains why this typically fails for that community?
So this is an area that sociologists have been studying for a really long time. The housing credit programs adopt and institutionalize and consecrate a set of kind of redlining maps that exclude people of color from the housing, from the government credit program. And this becomes an absolute engine of racial inequality. So being excluded from the federal credit programs means that you're excluded from neighborhoods where people can rely on the fact that a lot of people will be able to get mortgages and move in. And because of the way the U.S. political economy works, all sorts of things are tied to that. So what I mean by that is it means exclusion from high kind of tax wealthy neighborhoods with well-funded schools. It means exclusion from social networks and from a set of new job opportunities that are growing up in the suburbs. And it means exclusion for what's going to become, for what becomes the main form of wealth for American families. So, and it doing all of this in a way that it's also a way of being excluded from a massive social program that's helping family build wealth in a way that's not stigmatizing. So you're being excluded from a huge government form of assistance that works by helping kind of construct people as good financial citizens. And it doesn't come with a lot of the stigma that's associated with getting kind of a handout or charity.
Now, we started our conversation in our current time period, and you suggested, as I think many people would know, that the mortgage-backed securities have really been at the center of debates about the major causes of the most recent Great Recession. What happened to move securitization from a policy success, if not total, but a policy success, to a major policy failure? What changed in sort of bold terms that has made mortgage-backed securities a phrase that even a casual observer knows was a real problem in the aughts?
If you look at the end of the 1960s, there are increasing problems with the housing market. And I studied closely the Johnson administration's efforts to take on those problems. And within the existing economic and political institutions of the time, they felt like they really couldn't use the existing channels to solve that problem. To fix the housing problem, spending a lot of issuing a lot of money in mortgages, which would have pushed up government spending towards and deficit spending to the debt limit because it was happening right during the Vietnam War. So what the Johnson administration decided to do was take a securitization, which earlier versions of it kind of had been used throughout U.S. history. And in the post-war era, there wasn't a private market for reasons I discuss in the book. But the government offices are actually using those forms to bundle up government assets and sell them off all off book. And they decided to take this securitization and spin off Fannie Mae and have Fannie Mae use it. So the government makes this major investment in support for securitization at the end of the 1960s. And this is the foundation of the market that's going to kind of grow up and become the crisis. And it's still with us today. But when they're doing it, they're in such a different world. The way I like to think about it sometimes is imagine a flatbed truck that's pulling a house down a highway, and it has to get up a big hill. And the hill is kind of high interest rates at the time. They build with securitization a financial technology that really is very effective at attracting credit. And that's very good for getting up that hill. What they don't realize necessarily is what's about to happen on the other side of that hill, which is that interest rates are going to fall, which is going to speed up the market. There's going to be massive deregulation, which is like taking all the cops off the road, that there's going to be a huge change in information technology that's going to speed everything up. It's like putting hyperfuel into the truck that's carrying the home. So they build this tool at a time where they need to kind of overcome a problem, and they don't understand that all of these things in about 20 years are really going to spin out of control. And in fact, that's what happens.
The book is again titled American Bonds, How Credit Markets Shaped a Nation. This is one of those books that when you read the title, you might not first go to it, but you learn so much about American political development through the way these credit markets and lending policies work. The author, again, is Sarah Quinn, and the publisher is Princeton University Press. Sarah, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.